From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Happy birthday to Justin Christo from New Mexico. Your mom, Margot, sends the wishes. Later tonight, Dark Forces revisited the story of Bill Bean and his family. Here's what's happening. Technology, unbelievable. A groundbreaking device has been created that would allow soldiers to control military equipment and vehicles with just their thoughts. Scientists from several universities in the United States have created a new brain-computer interface strip. The device is connected to the upper neck, picks up brain signals, and converts them to digital information. This is unbelievable. Utah Republican Representative Chris Stewart has announced that the explosive whistleblower complaint concerning President Trump's July call with the Ukraine leader has now been declassified, and Stewart said that it doesn't contain any incriminating information. Lawyers for the whistleblower, a member of the intelligence community apparently, has confirmed that the whistleblower wanted to testify before Congress and was waiting on possible guidance from the acting director of national intelligence, Joseph McGuire. McGuire is set to testify himself on Thursday. The news came as President Trump has continued to push for transparency in the matter. Earlier in the day, the White House released a transcript of Mr. Trump's July call with the president of the Ukraine, showing that the president sought a review of Biden's family dealings in the country. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi, of course, from the Corsi Nation. Jerry, I don't think there's anything impeachable here, but it probably was not a good move on the president's part to make that call.
Well, I think, George, a lot of these things and conversations the president may have with other countries when they're scrutinized, you can always raise a question here or there, but I don't see anything in this conversation that is going to reach the level of an impeachment, not really seriously. I mean, already the Department of Justice has looked at the charge and decided not to press any criminal charges against President Trump. And I don't think there were any quid pro quo offered where President Trump is saying, either you investigate my political opponent, Joseph Biden, or I'm not going to give you aid. That conversation really was about President Zelensky in Ukraine saying, we want to fight the swamp here, too. And could you help us by getting Giuliani, who is attorney for President Trump, to assist us in finding out who the bad guys are in Ukraine? It's going to be very hard to take this conversation and interpret it in a way that's going to be able to impeach President Trump.
Jerry, if you were advising the president, what would you be telling him right now?
George, well, first of all, I don't advise the president. I don't think it's possible. President Trump is his own person and has the ability. I've always said about President Trump, one thing about him is I've known him not pretty casually. I was a guest at the Plaza for years, VIP guest, and I got to know him then. Donald Trump always is an attention freak. He demands attention.
He's got a big ego.
And he always wants people talking about him. It doesn't matter if you turn on every channel in the cable news, they're all talking about Donald Trump. Well, he loves that because it doesn't matter if they're criticizing him or whatever, but he's got to be the center of attention. And he demands attention. You can't get into a political environment, and they're all talking about Donald Trump. Well, in politics, that's likely to mean he's going to win. It's when they don't talk about you as a politician, you've got to worry.
Interesting. Okay, Jerry, let's keep in touch on this story. Dr. Jerome Corsi. Massachusetts has officially become the first state in the United States to ban, if temporarily, the sale of all electronic cigarettes, going further than states that only prohibited flavored products. The ban is effective immediately, will run until January 25th, according to the governor. A strengthening Hurricane Lorenzo grew into the fifth Atlantic hurricane of the season and is forecast to keep strengthening as another storm continues to swirl away from Puerto Rico. Let's check in with climatologist Dr. Tim Ball. Tim, this is a very active season after a pretty slow season the last few years. What's going on?
Well, what you've got is a change in the global climate. The Earth is cooling down, and the cool air is pushing further south. but also the warm air, the tropics, is the air is not able to push as far north. So where you get the cold and the warm meeting, that's where you get these storms and hurricanes developing. So what we're going back to is a traditional pattern of easterly waves forming off the coast of Africa and traveling across very warm tropical water and turning into hurricanes once they move away from the equator. So this is part of the pattern of change, and it's perfectly normal.
Okay, it's all cyclical then. Nothing strange going on here.
Nothing strange going on here at all, no.
All right, thank you, Tim. Dr. Tim Ball. Listen to this story. Tourists could fly from Britain to Australia in just 4 hours by the 2030s. That's not too long. With a new hypersonic engine being developed by scientists. Could you imagine that? In just 4 hours to go from Britain to Australia. Wow. Probably go from Los Angeles to New York in about 40 minutes. In a moment, Sir Charles Schulz III joins us. We're going out into space with the latest discoveries next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got quite a ride tonight. Here's Sir Charles Schulz III. He worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapon systems and computer-based automated test equipment. He wrote the nuclear EMP systems software for the Pershing II missile system, worked on the Patriot system as well. He was knighted and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence, and of course, he has several books out, including A Fossil's Hunter's Guide to Mars, The Living Galaxy. Sir Charles, welcome back, my friend.
Well, thank you, George. It's always a pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Did you hear that story, Britain to Australia in 4 hours by the 2030s?
Absolutely. You know, hypersonic flight has been a real dream for quite a while. It's finally coming to fruition.
What kind of an engine would do that?
Well, you know, there are a number of different ways of doing it. Modifications of jet engines that allow combustion that happens at supersonic speeds is key to making it happen.
Sure does. What's new with you?
Oh, let's see. I've just gotten exciting news. I'm going to be heading over to London in about 3 weeks to do another movie. But,
Maybe you can get out of one of those hypersonic planes if they had one, huh?
Yeah. No, I don't think that'll happen.
What kind of movie are you going to do?
It's one of the Marvel movies, but I can't say anything about it.
Oh, good for you. That's going to be a blockbuster again. They always are.
They always are. It's a lot of fun doing them, too.
That's super. How about space? What's happening up there these days?
Wow, we've got a handful of really interesting things going on. I know that the moon mission's the big thing. Everybody's sending something to the moon.
Sounds like you're fighting a little head cold, are you?
You know what? I think it's allergies. I was taking, I told somebody today I was taking one of those Allegras, and I said Alexa, and I thought, well, that's great. Now my sinus will be answering questions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you sound fine, but I could tell it's not quite you.
Yes, it's a little cloggy. Not much more you can do about that.
That's it. But anyways, what is happening in space these days?
Okay, well, of course, you know, a few months ago we had the Israeli lander that crashed and left tardigrades on the moon, the little very tough organisms, and people were concerned these things might wake up or recover and start doing things. That's very unlikely because they're still in a vacuum. They're in hibernation. The recent loss of the Indian lander was another thing, and they've been looking for it. India appears to have gotten a thermal image of the thing after it went down when they lost communication. Our sources at NASA have been looking around, and they found different images, a radar image, and they're also trying to find it with a lunar reconnaissance orbiter, but that area is in shadow right now. So for the moment, they think they might have found it, but they're not really certain. We'll see what happens.
Though we make it look easy to do robotics in space, it's very difficult, isn't it?
It is difficult, but what's interesting is countries that don't have the huge sort of budgets that we do can draw on a lot of the things that we've learned over the years, and now just about everybody's sending something into space. I mean, it's something that even a hobbyist can do with a little bit of money if they can hitch a ride on a booster.
What do you think of privatization of space these days?
I think it's the best thing that can happen. When you have something as important as space travel in the hands of just two or three governments or organizations, it really is stifled in development in terms of what you can do. When you get into the private industry, people have a lot of impetus to do things that are new and different, and they don't have the same sort of restrictions. I mean, that's why we're seeing the growth in Jeff Bezos' system, Blue Origin, and Elon Musk. Everybody is going to find a way to make a dollar on it, and this is one of the big growth industries. Tourism alone could supply us with a lot of income from space work. But you know what? We're still learning more things, just like we did during Apollo and Gemini.
Would you go to the moon if it was priced right?
You would. I would love to go.
I would do that, too. I'd go around and Heck, I wouldn't even mind landing for a little bit. What about Mars? That's a longer trip.
It is. And, you know, there's a lot of work trying to get to Mars right now. I think Elon Musk's big plan is to get somebody there by 2024 or earlier. But the Falcon 9 and the heavy lift, he could get to the moon pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Now. But his big plan, as you know, is to retire on Mars, and he's making huge strides. I know a lot of people are aware of the testing for his Starship engines and how it affected local neighborhoods. There's been a lot of controversy there. I mean, I guess if you think about it, if you're launching something thundering and loud around homes, you're going to have some sort of repercussions. Nevertheless, he's continuing the good work, and we're going to see some great things coming from that.
Now, the Chinese have landed on the far side of the moon, and they're doing a lot of interesting things. Anything exciting pop up from that mission?
Absolutely. This is one of the most fascinating stories because it's so unusual. Their U-2 lander that's on the far side of the moon found something very interesting in the crater, and they described it as a kind of a reddish jelly-like material. And people are like, what in the world could it be?
Like jello almost.
Right? Something like a jello mold, I suppose. But they found in a small crater an unusual jelly-like substance with a kind of a reddish-gold color. The pictures they released didn't do it much justice. It doesn't show a lot of detail. But, you know, I think I know what it is. I have a theory about it. It's very, very simple. Many times in the past, when there would be a fall of a meteor, people would rush out to see if they could find it because it was always something fascinating of a rock
right
off the planet. And sometimes they would discover a material called star jelly. Sometimes associated with the fall of a meteor, there would be some other material found. And it was a strange material that evaporated rapidly. It was a jelly-like substance. And historically, it's been found a number of times. I'm thinking that's what it is. And so that doesn't tell you what it is, but it just names the process. I think what it could very well be, this is very simple, but I think this is the answer. If you look at the outer solar system, we have a lot of things out there past the orbit of Neptune or Pluto, Kuiper belt bodies and frozen bodies, and they're covered with a reddish-brown, scubby material. This is called tholin. This is the stuff of life where organic material is formed from inorganic material in a natural process. And this material can be refrozen out in space for millions or billions of years. And if any of those bodies, such as a piece of a comet or an asteroid, approaches the inner solar system and falls to Earth, this material could thaw out. I think what we're finding is primordial organic material from the outer solar system that's fallen to Earth or fallen to the moon.
Interesting. Like just seeded the planet. I think we were seeded from comets ourselves.
And it's quite possible. Yeah. I know a lot of organic material could have come from space that way. We know there is so much material out there right now. And that's one of the reasons they knew when they landed on Mars, primarily back in 1976 with Viking, they expected to find organic material. It's falling on all the planets all the time.
So the gel you don't think is oozing from the moon?
No, not at all. It's certainly not sourced by the moon. It's something that is formed in space, in my opinion, and it could be a very simple organic material. But it's interesting in the fact that something as simple as a jelly-like material can resist the conditions of a vacuum and maintain what could be an environment that could support simple organisms.
What's going on with any news about the planets like Venus?
Well, that's a big one right there. You know, it was recently decided by looking at Venus's history and its atmosphere that it probably was able to support life for billions of years. Some large event occurred sometime in the past, possibly a billion years ago or more, that apparently changed its environment so much that it became inhospitable. It looks like possibly an impact, possibly a large volcanic event. Something released a huge amount of carbon dioxide into Venus' atmosphere, and as a result, its temperature soared. It just scoured any life off of the planet that might have existed.
Well, it's pretty close to the sun anyways.
Well, it certainly is. It receives a lot more sunlight than the Earth does. But what's interesting about this is we traditionally think of a planet like Venus, so close to the sun, as not being capable of supporting life. Well, now that we know that Venus apparently was capable of that, when we look at exoplanets, we have a better benchmark for what might be a habitable planet now.
We've got an asteroid coming relatively close to planet Earth. It's not going to hit us, but they're getting closer. Do you think we've been dodging bullets?
Well, there's no doubt that we have. We constantly have a barrage of smaller bodies all the time. Many years ago, like about 30 years ago, we had a network of satellites that did nothing but look for nuclear attack signatures. they would look for the flash of the atmosphere that looked like a nuclear explosion. And every now and then, they'd get a false trigger. And what it turned out to be is material entering our atmosphere, like a large meteor or possibly a fragment of an asteroid. So we do know that we've been getting these things all the time. Some of the tidal waves, small tidal waves that show up from time to time, are caused by chunks of rock from space of a significant size landing in the ocean.
Well, that's a good point. And if they're any bigger, you're going to get huge tsunamis. This one is 311 feet. I love the technology to be able to pinpoint the size of an asteroid.
Oh, absolutely.
But what do you think a 300-foot asteroid, if it hit in the ocean, could do?
Well, now that depends strictly on its velocity. I mean, we know that something that size, about the size of a football field, could have a very large impact, and it could cause some significant waves. But the most damage occurs when it occurs offshore from an area that has a broad, shallow coastal area, because it seems to concentrate the waves. And that way, well, absolutely, when you hit a deep water area, the waves don't seem so energetic. But when they get to shallower areas, they focus and they magnify. But here's the big thing. If you double the velocity of an object, it hits with four times as much kinetic energy. And the variety of speeds of objects that fall to Earth are controlled by where they came from and the direction in which they struck the Earth. Did we hit it as it was catching up to us, or did we run headlong into it as it was heading our way? So there's a fairly broad range of velocities. The faster ones could be far more damaging.
Now, for people who are trying to visualize a 311-foot asteroid, folks, just picture a football field, because it's about the same, and a football field-sized rock smashing into the planet. If it were to hit a city, what would happen, Sir Charles?
Oh, it would be devastating. You know, it would be quite comparable to a nuclear blast.
Oh, my God. Really?
Absolutely.
Just 300 feet?
Yes, because here's the issue. Kinetic energy, the energy of movement, is a very damaging force at these velocities. Many of the newer weapons they were developing back in the late 80s and early 90s depended not on an explosive, but on sheer velocity. Because if you could make something move 10 times faster than a standard projectile, it would hit with 100 times the force. So you can see that there's a squaring effect, a geometric effect.
They continue searching for exoplanets, and they continue to find them.
Yes, they do. And it's amazing. You know, if you look at the number of exoplanets we've found lately, we've got over 3,700 confirmed. I think 3,706 was the latest figure I got a couple of days ago. And that's a huge amount of worlds out there, Earth-like worlds. They figure every solar system, every star you look at, has planets these days.
I love space. It's just exciting. You know, when we come back from the break, let's go to Mars and let's talk about what's going on there. Because I think when you started coming on Coast to Coast with us, we were talking about anomalies on Mars, weren't we?
Absolutely. There were so many interesting things found that didn't get any investigation that really warranted it.
What about telescopes? What's new with those kinds of missions?
Well, we know that the James Webb is something they're really doing some progress on right now. They're getting ready to launch some really interesting telescopes. One of them, the size of a planet, is in research right now. That's an interesting thought.
The size of a planet?
Yes. There's an interesting dodge using the mass of a planet as a sort of a lens.
Ah, okay. Interesting. How do they come up with this stuff?
Well, anybody who looks at relativity understands that gravity curves space-time. And if you could put a telescope out of the outer reaches of our solar system, you actually could use the entire sun as a lens to focus images from far out in space. A telescope of that class could actually see continents on planets in the Andromeda Galaxy if we could do it.
The Soyuz spacecraft, the Russian spacecraft, which right now has been taking cosmonauts and astronauts up and down from the International Space Station, had a leak some time ago, and the Russians apparently say they know what caused it, but they won't reveal it. Why not?
You know, I don't know if it's just bad PR or what. I think a lot of us were aware of the hole that appeared in the space station a while back.
And they patched it with almost like gum or something like that.
Well, you know what? Actually, that's a very effective method, because the difference in air pressure between what's in the space station and what's out in the vacuum isn't that great. Anybody who's got some sort of gummy caulk material on something and tried to get it off will understand how tough it can be.
It sure is.
Yep.
It sure is. Stay with us, Sir Charles. We'll be back in a moment. Sir Charles' websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about space with him, and we will be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, every Wednesday for you Coast Insiders, we add two new shows from our Art Bell vault that we've opened up. This week, we delve into the world of conspiracies by way of a riveting episode from 1997 in which the late investigative journalist Jim Mars made a first appearance on Coast to Coast discussing his research into the alien agenda. Our second show, of course, is the Fascination Edition with author Robert Anton Wilson, who discusses the Illuminati. So make sure you're part of that if you're a Coast Insider. We'll be back in a moment with more with Sir Charles Schulz III. Let's talk about Mars. George Norrie back with you. We will take calls next hour with Sir Charles Schulz III as we're talking about all things space. Sir Charles, Mars, what was it about Mars that caught your attention?
Well, you know, it's a very Earth-like planet in a lot of ways, and it appears to show changes of color and season like a lot of people in the past had seen, and a lot of things gave us hints that it probably held some sort of life. And so, I mean, the very fact that it's the planet next door and it might hold life, yeah, those two things together make you ask a lot of questions. Fun place to explore, lots of things to learn that could tell us a lot of things about the Earth itself.
Speculate for us, paint us a picture. What do you think Mars looked like several billion years ago?
Well, very much like the Earth. It started out the same. It was made of the same solar system with the same materials. It had a lot of the same history and chemistry. It is a terrestrial rocky planet, and it had less gravity, so its atmosphere leaked away into space very rapidly. It cooled off rapidly because of its small size, so its volcanoes can't replenish its atmosphere or its ocean, but it would have been very much like the primitive Earth, a scummy ocean full of early microbes and the same sort of competition and evolution we see here.
And what happened to the waters? Did they evaporate up or did they sink down?
Well, a lot of it would have been lost to space, but, you know, just because of the low atmosphere pressure and the solar wind. However, a lot of it is still on the planet. Right now, the whole planet is in an ice age, and its oceans are still present, but they're there as glaciers. They're frozen
mm-hmm.
in the soil.
Now, most of the water then that might have evaporated, would they have had a lot of rainy seasons because of that, as all these ocean waters are floating off into space?
Well, that really wouldn't create a rainy season. That's just a drying, a desiccating effect. And nevertheless, there would have been a lot of rain on the planet, and we could tell that there had to have been some sort of biological activity for the very fact that the planet is red. It's the color of rust. So there had to be water and oxygen present in a large amount, just as we had on the Earth. You know, there's a period in the Earth's history called the Great Rusting, and during that period, microbes that were producing oxygen for the first time started weathering the planet. Well, the fact that we see Mars covered by the Great Rusting effects as well tells us that there had to have been life there.
What about the possibility of intelligent life?
I don't think so at all, because the conditions were very harsh. From what I see, there was never an atmosphere of any great thickness in the last billion years, and so it would have been the oceans. Everything would have lived in the water. It would have been the surrogate atmosphere. So if there was ever anything intelligent on Mars, it had to come from somewhere else.
Interesting. Okay, and in terms of life, what might it have been?
It would have been mostly marine life. There certainly would have been some things to emerge on the land. But keep in mind, there's one very important factor that would keep most of its life in its oceans. No ozone layer. The life on Earth didn't come out of its oceans until there was a thick ozone layer that allowed things to get out of the water without being killed.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. What about Europa? What do you think's going on there, one of Jupiter's moons?
Now, that is one of the most fascinating environments in our whole solar system. Here we have a moon that's very small, has maybe 5% of the gravitational force that the Earth does, and it has a shell of ice and an ocean on the inside. When you look at that little moon, you see an interesting brown color mixed in the ice. Well, an analysis of that color, looking at its spectrum, shows that it is precisely the same color as bacteria that's been damaged by radiation.
Hmm.
And Jupiter's magnetic field traps an incredible magnetic load of radioactive forces there, like our Van Allen belts. So particles from space and from the sun have created an immense field of radiation. It would basically take you about 3 feet of lead to shield yourself from the effects. Now, organisms under the ice in Europa, if any exist, would be quite comfortable there. But it's a very likely target for finding living things in our solar system right now.
Do they have liquid water under there?
yes, there are huge pockets of liquid water, basically the same as our oceans. And the reason for that is because even though it's very far from the sun and very cold, Jupiter itself has an immense magnetic field and also a gravitational field. And as these moons orbit the planet, they're being flexed and kneaded, and it heats the interiors and creates these oceans, keeps them from freezing.
How deep do you think the ice is on Europa?
It appears the ice is roughly anywhere from 1 to 20 kilometers based on where you look. And a good average is about 10 kilometers thick. So call it 6 miles of ice.
Wow. That's a lot of ice.
It is a lot of ice. But fortunately, if we wanted to get samples and see what's inside, we could go to one of the areas where there's a crack in the ice. Now, that shell of ice is being flexed just like the planet, and it fractures. And so materials that are inside the oceans can ooze up through those cracks and freeze on the surface. It would be a very simple maneuver to land on the ice, scoop up some of the material, and start searching for organic compounds and possibly organisms.
What is it about space, Sir Charles, that caught your attention when you were a younger person?
Well, everything is in space when you think about it. We are truly in space. We just happen to be stuck on a planet. If you look at the world around us and you look at all the places we explore and how fascinating they are and their differences, you wonder what might be out there in the universe. And so space is a place where everything is, and if we could reach orbit, we're halfway to anywhere in the universe.
What are CubeSats?
You know, when they send this next mission to the moon in this new capsule, this Orion capsule, they will be launching a number of these CubeSats. And a CubeSat is a very small, standardized type of satellite. You can go online and get the drawings. And many hobbyists and college groups have built and flown CubeSats. So it's a standard that determines the dimensions, the mass, and the electronic interface for these sorts of things. A lot of people build them, launch them piggybacking on other rocket launches. It's a very compact, manageable system. Imagine your old telephone in a booth versus the cell phone in your pocket. Well, the CubeSat is that version of a satellite. It's a tiny, compact satellite.
What happened to Russia, then the Soviet Union? They seem to have given up trying to go to the moon.
Well, now that's very interesting. I think one of the things that's very important is to recognize that anything you invest money in needs to have a yield, has to have a payoff.
Yes, sure.
It's expensive, and there's no place to go there. There's certainly not a McDonald's or a Starbucks. And so if you get there, you really don't have much to do except look at a big rock. If you could monetize that, if you could turn it into an opportunity to mine and find materials, that's great. Russia's had a lot of plans, as do India and China, to go to the moon specifically for minerals or other valuable materials. I mean, early on, exploration was a big thing, and it drove our technology growth. Now, today, I don't think Russia is so much interested in that as they are in getting something happening that's going to help them out as a country.
Well, they don't have that many resources in terms of money anymore.
You know, that's true. I mean, when the Soviet Union broke up, instead of having one monstrous, huge financial organization, you had 20, 21 little countries, each with their own interests, and it makes it much more difficult to have a coalition that can fund something as effective as our space program.
Our last mission to the moon was Apollo 17, 1972.
That's right.
So in theory, we haven't been back to the moon until then. That was 47 years ago. You know, we just celebrated our 50th anniversary of the first moon landing. Why did we stop?
And again, it came down to economics. Once we had achieved the goal of beating the Russians, of getting there, we really had so many new toys technically to play with and so many things to do. But the money, the backing for this sort of thing, dried up very rapidly. We were fighting with Congress all the time to get funding for a lot of this stuff. And understand that space flight is not without a lot of politics. Think about if you're a senator or you're representing a certain area, you're going to fight to get funding into your state if it pays your workers and gets you more votes. It's not so much about the technology as it is controlling the flow of money, when really we should be focused on the technical developments and how it can improve our standard of living here. I mean, just think about what we can do cleaning up the environment using space technology.
There are some who say that we need to be able to go into space to leave the planet one day. Do you see that as a possibility?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we are in a position where we're basically poisoning the planet. And while we do have the technology to clean it up, None of it's being implemented. If we have the ability to travel in space, if we have the ability to terraform or make livable any other environment, but also proves that we have the ability to clean up the Earth. I think in some respects, people always need the ability to study, to plan, to move somewhere else, to explore. Exploration's in our blood. And when we get off the planet, we also have the advantage of not leaving all of our eggs in one basket. As a lot of people have pointed out, some very brilliant people, if we were to have one natural disaster on Earth or one nuclear war or one biological catastrophe, we could wipe out life on Earth. And if we have a number of isolated colonies throughout our solar system, that's much less likely. We have the ability to have a backup plan. We have other places we can live. And a disaster would burn itself out locally, and we'd still have humanity.
So Charles Schulz with us. Do you think it would be worthwhile to prolong life, even if you lived on another planet with basically nothing to do? Let's say you're in some bubble trying to grow your own food, for example, because eventually you're going to run out, as opposed to just staying on planet Earth and toughening it out until it's the end?
You know, prolonging life is basically the only thing a lot of people are doing these days. They're doing their best to live as long as they can. But the big issue here is we, as a technical civilization, are on the brink of amazing developments. We've just recently been able to upload the whole neural structure of small organisms into a computer, and people are pushing to upload the human mind into a computer. That would effectively mean that you're basically immortal. Prolonging your life, you know, we always think of it from the organic perspective. We're all organisms, and we eat, we live, we die. We age and we spoil, just like a rotten fruit, in effect. And we are fighting to reverse that and end that so that we can live forever. So when you say, you know, extending your life on a planet, living in a bubble somewhere, stop and think for a moment what we do everywhere we move. We always start with the minimums. We tough it out, and then we build a paradise. We build all of our tools. We make life better. We wouldn't live in a bubble forever on another planet. We would eventually make huge cities and infrastructure. That's what we do.
I saw a homeless person last night leaving work, sleeping on the sidewalk with a shopping cart next to him.
Yeah.
Full of stuff, junk. But for him, it was his possessions, his worldly possessions. And as I drove past him, I'm thinking he's alive. He's existing. But is he living? And there's a paradox there between how you really want to live your life and just existing. Could you do what he did? Could you live like that? I mean, that's how you would live on Mars. You'd be like that.
Well, only up to a point. One of the problems that we have in society, homelessness is a societal failure in many cases. You know, years ago we knew how we could live. We could go out there, cut a piece of land up and grow some food, and we could be independent.
Not many people can do that anymore.
Exactly. We are now living in a society where technology has put us in a position where we almost all work for other people. And when that work isn't there, when we don't have the skills to do otherwise, the money to get started in the business, we basically are out on the street, and there aren't any options. There's no backup plan. And, this is one of the causes of homelessness. But the other one is, there are a lot of forms of mental illness or economic problems or medical bills or something that put you on the street, and it can be very, very difficult to recover
sure.
from that.
Well, I see. I think that homeless person would be more apt to live on Mars than you or I would be.
And that's also another thought. You see, if you're living in an environment like that, there is a premium on getting you to stay alive. You have to live well. If you're putting up a colony on another planet, you depend on the abilities and presence of other human beings to get that job done. You work together as a community. We need each other. On the Earth, we've been marginalized in a lot of ways. Space might provide a little bit of what's necessary for people to see how much we depend on other human beings. We're so isolated today, we stand there with our eyes directed into our palms or our hands on a cell phone. We have all the information of humanity at our disposal, and we look at cat videos and share jokes.
6-mile-wide asteroid, if it were coming this way and we had a year's notice, would they tell us about it?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I can't get into the heads of these people. It would make almost...
It's a planet killer.
Oh, it's a planet killer, absolutely. It would make no sense to keep it quiet. But on the other hand, not everybody would keep it quiet.
No, some amateur would find it.
Well, absolutely. Something that size, somebody would spot it. Here's the thing. We actually do have technologies that would allow us to move an asteroid like that if we had a year's lead time. And it would be a monumental effort, but we could do it. And I'll tell you something. It doesn't take nuclear weapons or giant lasers or huge spacecrafts to do. If you were to send up a thin solar mirror made of like Mylar plastic and a number of them and get them near that asteroid and use the sunlight to heat the asteroid to the point where portions of it vaporize, they would act like mini rocket engines. They would push it. That's right. We only need to change the course of that asteroid by roughly 7 minutes of arrival time.
Nuking it might not be a good idea because then you've created a zillion little particles that come flying down on you.
That's true. The other thing is, it's called transfer function. When you blow off a nuclear weapon next to an asteroid, how much of the energy actually gets deposited into moving the asteroid? Not much. There is a strategy that was developed a while back where you would take two nukes. The first would be exploded right at the surface to produce a huge cloud of plasma and vaporized material. The second would be exploded shortly afterwards to make that plasma absorb the energy and act as a thrusting agent.
Would you want to know that you had a year left, or would you just want to live your days like you're living them?
I would rather know, because perhaps it would change the way we think and the way we act with each other. I mean, we need to be kinder and more human to each other.
I think we'd be worse.
Well, yes, and that's because the worst seems to emerge in people in times of
There'd stress. Be panic. Oh, it would be awful. Awful. I mean, look what happens with a snowstorm in the Midwest. When they announce that there's going to be snow, people attack the stores, they push, they fight. Or on the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, the shopping season,
people
literally duke it out in a store over a sweater.
TVs.
Yeah. I mean, so you can imagine if they say, folks, an asteroid's coming this way, we will all be wiped out, it's over.
Well, here's the thing. We would hope that the small fraction of people who have huge resources at their disposal would recognize the necessity of pulling everybody together to get something done.
I'd want to be on the air, Sir Charles. I want to be interviewing you, for example.
Oh.
And then all of a sudden, all we hear is...
Well,
that's it.
I guess there's a number of ways to go out that might be considered honorable, but for me, going out at all is not a good thing. I think that if we can support each other and deflect the asteroid, the things that we would learn in that effort would be more than enough to help us make life
sure.
better everywhere.
Oh, I think you have to try. There's no doubt about that. You can't give up. You've got to do everything you can as a world to fix that.
You may remember a number of years back, I made connection with the Space Island Group, Gene Myers.
Yes.
And we worked on a couple of things there. And one of the things that I worked on was my solar thermal engine, a type of primitive plasma engine. And the refinements of that, the plasma engine that I came up with, was a tool for using to move their satellites to higher Earth orbit. And one of the things that came out of that was a type of shielding for radiation for spacecraft. This is where you have a large array of solar collectors making electrical power, and that power runs your plasma engine. Well, there's an interesting side effect of that, and that is if you wrap your power lines into a large solenoid, a large coil around your crew compartment, and you run the power through it, you generated a huge magnetic field that would deflect cosmic ray particles because they're charged, they're ions.
What's new in the book world for you?
I haven't been writing much lately. I've been so busy doing other jobs, preparing for, I've been doing stunt work on a lot of movies, and I've been doing technical work for systems around here.
Is that what you do a lot, stunts?
Yeah, I work on the... what's called wire work, the winch systems that fly people.
Let's talk about that for a little bit when we come back, Sir Charles. That's fascinating. And we'll take an hour of phone calls with Sir Charles Schulz III next on Coast to Coast AM.